As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show and our latest batch of listener questions. On today's show, we're asking what's next for Sergino Dest. We're considering an NWSL European crossover, Jetsons and Flintstones style. And we're asking why there are so many gosh darn soccer teams in London. My name's Ryan Bailey. Joining me today, a man who loves a last minute FA Cup comeback, Taylor Rockwell. Hello.
Hello. I really, really did. That was super fun. It feels fun to be a Manchester United fan these days. It feels, to be honest, like even more fun, this is a bit of trolling, to be texting with my Manchester United like supporting friends and especially kind of gleefully talking about the problems at Liverpool and not have to immediately think about the problems at my own club. It's fun times. It's fun times to feel stable.
Fun times indeed. Man United winning 3-1 over West Ham. A couple of post-90-minute goals there. Fulham in the quarterfinals for Man United. Man City versus Burnley also coming up. The Vincent Kompany derby. Fun times indeed. Oh, yeah. I was watching, personally, Taylor, I was watching Arsenal drink Everton's milkshake at the same time yesterday. So,
Ryan, there we are. I've done some thinking before we get to the full-on introductions. I'm just going to keep going with Man United for a moment because it occurred to me as I poo-pooed...
Can't stop them.
You cannot. As I poo-poo the League Cup, sort of is like, we'll see what happens after that. And at least both Ryan and Graham, maybe Joe a little bit, were like, all right, guy, like, you've won silverware. I would love for that to be the case. I did think some more about it and how, like, when I talk about being a Man United supporter and being frustrated, it is really, like, sort of a disservice to then people who support clubs like Wimbledon and Sterling. It's like, poor you. You had to wait a whole 6 years. Like, your club wasn't relocated or underfunded and never will be. And so I felt kind of bad about that. And I think what I would just like to say is that maybe your club should just be better. And that might
happen. God. Oh, see, this is what I was talking about. The dynamic of this podcast is going to change fundamentally.
Well done. Oh, yes, Taylor. So good.
Graham,
so good.
You heard it there, Graham. We should have picked the most successful team in the world instead of a local
one. That's where
we
went wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Your fault there, Graham. Might as well introduce you now, Graham Ruthven. Hello, how are you doing?
Hi, Ryan. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very good. I understand you're walking in a Cremonense wonderland right now. Cremonense with their first win in Serie A since March 96 this week.
Wow. I mean, we should mention they haven't been in Serie A every season since March 96. They have been going up and down the divisions, so that maybe accounts for why they've had to wait so long for a win. But you are right. They beat Jose Mourinho's Roma. Was that two nights ago or was that last night? I can't quite remember.
It was this week. Yeah.
And that's our first win of the whole season. We had a question from a listener early in the season which asked, which team will go the season or is more likely to go the season without a win, Elche in La Liga or Cremonense in Serie A? I believe both teams have wins now, so neither is the answer. We finally have an answer months later. But yeah, Jose Mourinho didn't take that very well. I believe he got sent off and then had a rant after the match.
He did indeed. He's also in trouble for going to a Roma Lazio youth game and encouraging the players to dive and booing the Lazio
no
players.
No way.
Yeah.
That can't be real.
Good stuff, right?
Is that all genuine? Good. Is that genuine? That is unbelievable.
Just what the internet's told me, Graham. I wasn't there, but we'll see. We'll see about that one. By the way, Sampdoria bottom in Serie A now in dreadful form. Cremonese creeping above them. Poor, as a kit man, as a kit lover, Graham, Sampdoria, you've got to pour some out for them. Classic, the red and white stripe on the blue. Beautiful.
And then the traditionally, is it like a diamond sort of thing on like a badge, like a diamond badge? Anyway, it's a very nice shirt. So I'm now starting the campaign to save Sampdoria. Save Samp for the kits.
Thank you, by the way, to Eric Milner, who emailed a series of Cremonese facts and details about their season, including that prior to this match, they had only led for a total of 119 minutes in the entirety of the season. So 5.7% of the time in like all of the matches they've played,
wow,
they had been leading. Now it's 180 minutes. They're up to two full matches, says Eric. Lots of other details in there. But yeah, a fascinating season in which they could also still win the Coppa Italia.
Yeah.
And I think they've gotten past Roma and Napoli.
They beat Roma in that competition as well. So again, I'm sure Mourinho loved that.
Indeed. They are Roma's kryptonite. They will continue to be their kryptonite. Rounding out our pack, guys, a man who may or may not believe Ted Lasso set us back 20 years and cursed Jesse Marsh. That, Joseph Lowry, is what Jim Curtin said this week. What say you?
Wow, I was wondering where that was going. Did I accidentally say that on a podcast at some point? Was I dreaming about that and you have some sort of inceptioned my dream? I'm not really sure what happened there, but I don't think that's true. I feel like it's not. I think Jesse Marsh probably would have been fine if he'd won more games at Leeds. seemed like people mostly liked him there. And so I don't really know that applies here. But Jim Curtin's been dropping some heat lately. He's been talking about the union. He's been talking about how people that give anonymous quotes to The Athletic are cowards. Like, this is, I think that was Jim Curtin. Shoot, maybe now you guys have got me doubting. I gotta look this
up.
But
it was Jim Curtin.
Okay,
it was. Because it was an MLS executive that said that the union aren't actually that good, and he basically told them to shut up.
Right.
After so winning their first
Jim
game
Curtin,
4-1.
Curtin's been in good form recently, Ryan. I love it.
That man has embodied what it is to be from Philly, I gotta say.
Yes, he has. Yes, he has, Taylor.
Indeed. Those comments in The Athletic if you want to read on there. Let's get to the listener questions. By the way, patreon.com/TotalSoccerShow if you'd like bonus episodes, bonus videos, and much, 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 much more. I've just arrived in London. I'm going to a Wimbledon game this weekend where I will make a video. So there's a little Plough Lane tour coming to
buy a pie
there as well. Oh, yeah. I'll buy it. There is a whole row. They've got a name for it, like the row for where all the food stands are, and they switch them up all the time, Graham. You'd love it. Apart from the fact it's in London, you'd love it.
And so in my world, this is the equivalent of what Taylor did at the top of the show, basically bragging about supporting a winning team. That's what you're doing to me right now.
Yeah. But you put on the feed that Sterling, Albion are doing some amazing combos of pies pretty soon, right?
Yeah. Oh, so I'm also going to do a video this weekend, and because the pie, the speciality pie for this weekend, the suppliers of the pies now tweet me and tag me in their tweets every single week, which is very on brand for me. I don't know whether I am proud or ashamed of that. But the
You're
speciality
proud of it,
pie
don't
for
lie. You're absolutely oh, yes. proud of it. I'm not buying
yes,
that for
am,
one
yeah.
second.
I am proud of it. Hence why I put it in our chat. The speciality pie for this weekend is mixed pakora, and that will consist of chicken tikka mixed with doner meat with pink pakora sauce. I cannot wait, and I plan on doing a video on that specific pie.
I know Ryan wants to get to the questions. Graham, are you the most famous Sterling Albion supporter on earth right now? I mean, just to give context, like if listeners out there aren't on Twitter, like Graham is like a decent sized deal on Twitter. I think he's got the most followers of any of us. You've got a lot of followers on Twitter, like 20,000 or so, maybe it's more than that. Like, are you the guy?
So this is a source of pain for me. There's another journalist who is also a Sterling Albion fan called Robin Berner. We chat sometimes with Sterling Albion, and he's got more followers than me. So I might be number two.
You're number
Robin's
two.
Robin's a big tennis guy as well, Graham. He might have you there too.
I know. He's basically the better me.
I'm so sorry to hear that.
Wait, if we're just going with followers, then does that mean that we need to start a campaign to get Graham above this Robin fellow
what's
in terms
the gap?
Of followers? And then, what is the gap, Graham?
It's not, it's manageable. Hold on.
Okay,
Robin is,
all right.
It's not that manageable. He's on 39,000 and I am on, what am I on? I am on 26. So yeah, a fair distance to make up. All right. The Pie fans, give me a follow.
Let's end this measuring contest here, shall we? I'll just say, Taylor, do you remember in The Simpsons where the hot dog vendor follows Homer around and he goes, lady, he's putting my kids through college. I think that's what the pie guys are doing with Graham right now.
That's why they tag me.
I would go with that. I would go with the episode of The Office in which everyone is just trying to sell Kevin Girl Scout cookies because they know that he will buy more than everyone in the office combined. I also just picture Graham having like a gaggle of like a mother goose with all of her little baby geese behind her. It's just Graham with a series of pie men following behind him in case he gets hungry. Also what I'm picturing at his games.
I'd welcome that.
All right. All right, listener question stands are champing at the bit for some questions, so let's get to it now. Matt Adler has got in touch. This is one of the hardest questions we had in a very, very long time, guys. Who would you take out of Marcus Rashford, Vinicius Jr., or Kvyat Kvaratskhelia for the rest of the season if you had to pick one of those players? And does your answer change if you were thinking longer term? Joe, this is not an easy one to throw to you first with. I suppose it depends on your needs, depending on your team. But, I mean, can we say who's in the best form right now? I'm not even sure. You can make a case for all of them.
Yeah, you could. I think Rashford is probably in the best form at the moment. He's been really, really hot. And he fits well, Ryan, to your point about style, in a team that is more transition-based, right? Erik ten Hag. Graham, you and I have talked about this a number of times, right? Erik ten Hag probably wants to have a bit more possession with Manchester United than he's had this season. And Rashford, I think, is a real beneficiary from that style, that more transition-heavy style, because he can break in beyond. He's like Mbappe sort of in that way. But my pick for this, both for the rest of this season and beyond, is Vinicius Jr. I think he is just the best player of the three. Kvaradona has broken out this year and has been exceptional. And these are all three, like, just elite attacking players. Vinicius Jr. doesn't have as many goals, but, I mean, you go through and look at some of his other numbers, I think he's a better creator than either of those other two players. And, I mean, we've seen the goal scoring from him before, right? He scored 17 goals last season. He's not quite on pace for that this year. His production hasn't quite reached that level, but I think he is the most well-rounded player. I think he is the one that you feel most confident is going to get you some sort of goal or assist contribution coming into a game. And if we do expand this out, like Matt says, to thinking long-term, then I'm extra locking in my answer as Vinicius Jr. He's 3 years younger than Marcus Rashford. He's about a year older than Kvaradona, but they're both 22 right now, so it's a little bit less than a year. You're 22 until you're 23, just as a fun fact for people. Yeah, thanks, Graham. Appreciate that. So Vinicius Jr., both for his longevity potential and I think for how well-rounded his game is, and we've seen that with Real Madrid, he's my pick here, and I'm not really sure that it's all that close in my mind, even though I know full well that you can make really good arguments for all of them.
Graham, what argument will you make? I think I'd agree with Joe, with Rashford being perhaps the most informed, certainly in terms of goal scoring out of those guys.
Yeah, so I think Rashford is maybe the odd one out in that, in my mind, he is a wide goal scorer. And I know Vinicius and Kvaratskhelia also score goals, but I think they're maybe a little bit more rounded in their attacking output. Certainly in the case of Kvaradona, I think he's more rounded than Rashford. So if I'm giving a boring answer, it depends on what sort of team I have. If I'm taking any of these three players for Stirling Albion, I'm not picky. I'll take any of them, to be honest. But if I'm starting a team from scratch, I need to know how the team plays. If I need a goal scorer, Rashford, I think, is probably the sharpest goal scorer out of those three. He can play through the middle as well. He can play on the right. And as Joe says, if I'm playing in quick transition and I have a goal scoring number nine, then... I don't have a goal-scoring number nine, then Rashford is maybe the guy I'm going to. If I do have a goal-scoring number nine and I need someone to complement him, maybe Vinicius is the player that I go to. And if I need someone to play through and offer a little bit of everything, it's probably Kvaradona, Kvaratskhelia. So I'm very much sitting on the fence with all three. Long-term, I kind of differ with Joe here, and this is maybe me gambling because I agree right now Vinicius Jr. I think is a better player than Kvaratskhelia. But I just look at how this is his first season at the top level and how good he has been in that first season. It is frightening to think what he could be in a few more seasons. And I know Napoli have been great this season, but he's not surrounded by the players he would be surrounded by at Real Madrid or Man City. And Vinicius Jr. is already in that setting. So maybe Kvaradona doesn't get up to that level, but in my mind, there's a potential payoff that he gets even better beyond this stage. So actually, long term, I would take Kvaradona.
Graham, as a counterpoint to that, Rashford and Vinny, you could argue, are proven quantities, whereas with Kvaradona, Francis Jefferson was good in his first season. There's another way around it.
Yeah, well, I don't think Francis Jeffers was ever... he was never compared to Maradona, let's put it that way. There was never a nickname that likened him to Maradona.
Jeffredona?
But I think maybe... I can't even think of a nickname off the top of my head. I was going to try and come up with one, but there's nothing there with Francis Jeffers. Yeah, I think maybe, Ryan, that says something about our personalities. I'm a gambler. I'm going to go with Kvaratskhelia because he might get even better, and then... undoubtedly, down the line, he will suffer some sort of bad injury, and that will cost me a lot if I were to buy him.
All right. Taylor, for the sake of balance, I guess you've got to go for Rashford.
I actually had Rashford last on my list, probably because I have watched him the most and have the most familiarity with him, and thus he has frustrated me at times far more than Vinicius Jr. or Kvaradona have. Rashford is in excellent form. I think he has the most goals of any of these three this season, but there were also plenty of times in seasons past when I felt like his decision-making was poor. He didn't finish chances that I thought he could have. He should have done better there. Let me just make Joe's eye twitch a little bit. And so I think I have just more of the back and forth of, like, yes, I've seen him be excellent and world-class. I've also seen him missed the target when he absolutely could have at least put it on frame. And so I think because of that familiarity, I look at somebody like Vinny Jr., who is my number one, because he is a player who just I think of as, if your team is up against him, no matter what, there is also always a possibility he's going to create something. And he feels like one who, even if you have three players on him, a la Liverpool, he can still find a way to score. And I think he can be that difference maker. So too can Rashford, so too can Kvaradona. But I think Vinicius Jr. is just that little bit of a difference maker, that little bit finds a way to make something happen out of nothing. Rashford can do that, but I think also just has some of those down periods as well. I'm sure they all do, but because I'm more familiar with Rashford's, and I think Kvaradona, for the reasons you laid out, Ryan, just that one sort of season, we don't have a ton of other data to go off of when it comes to playing in the top flight. So for me, Vinicius Jr.
Yeah. And on Rashford, I don't want to turn this onto the Rashford pylon because he's a world-class player. He is... been in exceptional form this season, but what's his record, like 17 goals in 20 games or something like that? No matter what it is, it's a lot of goals in a lot of games, and you just kind of think, is this real? Like, is there a drop off coming at some point? Because that has been the way of Marcus Rashford's career to date. He's never been as high as this. This is as good as he has ever been. But nonetheless, when he's been good previously, and he was very good when Solskjaer came into Manchester United, then a new manager comes in, he drops off. With Kvaradona and Vinicius, you kind of feel like, particularly with Vinicius, if Ancelotti leaves at the end of the season, a new manager comes in, I still think Vinicius is going to be one of the best players in the world. And I'm not really sure with Rashford if that is the case yet. I guess I just need a larger body of work from Rashford, which is a little bit weird because he is the oldest of the three. But nonetheless, that's kind of where I am on him.
Yeah, I think and that helps kind of like tick some boxes for me or connect some dots that hadn't been connected, Graham. I think because it's Ancelotti at Real Madrid, there is that also idea that sometimes his response to going 2-0 down is like, let Vinny cook. Vinny, go do things and we'll see what happens. And I think sometimes gives his players that individual freedom to try to create. And I think that's maybe a luxury that Napoli don't have this season. I think Manchester United under Erik ten Hag don't really have this season. And so I think I've seen Rashford sort of put the team on his back and create something from nothing less. I see him more finishing excellent team moves or being in the right place to make something happen. And that's incredibly important and has been a difference maker for Manchester United. But if we're talking about bringing in one player to sort of be a difference maker, but also make the team function better, I think Vinicius Jr. is a more clear-cut option for me.
All righty, Matt, thank you very much for that question. We're going to take a quick pause. When we come back, plenty more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Catch all new episodes Thursdays on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back. Hugh B has been in touch, who says, I'd like to hear your thoughts on what's going on right now with Sergiño Dest. Left off the Champions League squad for Milan, with reports they're unwilling to pay the 20 million fee to sign him this summer. He's not in Xavi's plans at Barcelona. What would be a good move for Dest at this point? What does he need to do to be ready for 2026? And do we see him featuring in the Nations League and Gold Cup competitions this summer, given the uncertainty of his situation? Ooh, Taylor, what would you like to start us off with, Mr. Dest?
I think I'll take us back to kind of maybe try to explain how we got to where we are, and then we can look at what comes next. But for people who aren't as familiar or haven't been following Sergiño Dest for quite some time, he broke through as a youngster with Ajax, but even when he makes this move to Barcelona, when he starts getting linked with that move, he isn't the out-and-out every-single-game starter at Ajax, at least not to my memory. Mazraoui is still very much in that conversation. Taliafico, I think, also splitting time with Dest, and then other options at Ajax as well. So I felt like we had a player in Dest who chose to play for the United States who was this exceptional talent but still had some polishing to be done. And that was where I really liked the idea of him going to Bayern Munich. That was the other team that were heavily linked with him. And it was reported that that's where he would end up. I still have that sort of what if scenario, because I think instead he goes to Barcelona and he is exactly the player that comes from Ajax. He's a very good attacking fullback. He can create, he can take people on, he can provide assists, he can score goals himself, and he is a big player in that way. I don't think he has the defensive side of his game polished, and that was a thing when we first saw him start playing. My big concern was vertical balls over the top in 1v1 scenarios. He got beat by like three of those in his first game for the US, that he just couldn't track the ball and the player at the same time. And from there, it does seem like the knock on him has been defensive awareness is poor, positioning is lacking, and he can basically dive into challenges. He makes like the wrong decision at the wrong moment. And to me, that is a player who still hasn't sort of developed the defensive side of his game. I think that was a thing that started to happen under Ronald Koeman, because I think Ronald Koeman was focused on Dest. He thought he could make a player of Dest who could make that team better. He still says that. There was a quote from him about Dest being a better player than Sergi Roberto. He doesn't understand what happened at Barca. What I think happened is that Xavi came in and looked at all the things he needed to fix and figure out. And I think he didn't really want to have to deal with a defender who couldn't defend. And I think he didn't have the time to develop Dest the way he needed to be developed. So he goes to Milan on loan. And maybe there's an idea that they're a defensive team. They'll figure it out, except that their defense isn't very good either. And I think Dest hasn't gotten that instruction, hasn't sort of learned how to develop in a way that he can defend at that world-class level. And so what happens next? My hope is that he goes somewhere where he plays every single game or most games, but at the same time is with a coach who has the patience and the ability to teach and sort of coax out that more complete defensive performance. So we still get the attack, but we still get the defensive side of things. That is my sort of read on Dest. I think he doesn't control defensive situations. I think when he's 1v1 with somebody, he is not sort of baiting them into making the wrong decision. I think he is oftentimes reacting to what the attacker is doing. Sometimes when you're reacting, you're going to get that right. Sometimes you're going to get it wrong. But I think the best defenders in the world have more control over that situation. And I don't think that's a thing that he has fully developed yet.
All right. Joe, what do you think? What's the next jumping off point for Sergiño Dest?
Yeah, I think for me, Dest's ceiling at this point, and I know he's still young, he's 22. I have real concerns about his ability to impact an elite European club. He failed to do so at Barcelona. He's failed to do so far at Milan. Although one thing that hasn't been mentioned a lot in the public discussion around Dest's time at Milan is how many injuries he's dealt with. He's missed a bunch of games with injuries. As far as I'm aware, that played a part in him being dropped from the Champions League squad for Milan heading into the round of 16. So, I mean, there have been issues here that really aren't in his control entirely, but Dest, I don't think, is good enough for Bayern or Barca. At this point, I think it's pretty clear that he's not elite, but he is very good, right? His value is in progression, his value is in possession. So his actual level, in my view, is probably a team that's trying to qualify for the Europa League, maybe a Europa League team or a team that's challenging for the Champions League spots, but is closer to 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th in a major league. I think he can be a very good player, and I still think he's a massive player for the U.S. men's national team, which is kind of the lens with which this question is being asked. But as far as a club goes, there's not really like an ideal situation in my mind, because like I said, you know, the dominant teams in Europe that want to keep the ball that you would think Dest would thrive in, he's never shown that he can really defend at that level or that he can create at that level in the final third. He gets you to the final third. He gets you some good press resistance and build up. But I'm concerned that the teams that are going to try to be that next tier down below are going to defend too much for Dest to be really useful. And I think ultimately he can find that balance. He'll probably grow into that. But as far as the next step for Dest, it really is this summer, go and play either the Gold Cup or the Nations League with the U.S. men's national team. That's going to happen, barring injury. Nothing that's happened at club level will prevent him from going to represent the U.S. He seems to have really enjoyed the World Cup, talked about, you know, how good that was for him and how much he enjoyed his time there with the team. So I would imagine it'll be Nations League, not Gold Cup, just because of the length between the two and how many games players will have played over the course of this season. I think he'll go to the Nations League. I think he's probably going to end up back at Barcelona, and then they're going to have to find something to do with him. Dest, it seems like, wants to have a place where he can play. When he went to Milan, he said, like, I hope they buy me. I think that's a direct quote from what Dest said. So he wants to go somewhere where he thinks he can get minutes. It hasn't worked out at Milan. There will be a club out there that wants him because he's still hugely talented. He has that international profile. But I don't have a great read or feel for the type of club or the type of style, I guess I should say, or the specific name of a team that Dest will really thrive at.
Joe, I have an idea that I've stumbled upon that I'm now into, but my first question for you, obviously you are not a doctor, you do not know his medical history, but would you have, how big would your concerns be about him coming to the Premier League?
I mean, equal to other places. I'm not sure that the Premier League is like infinitely more physical or more aggressive than other leagues. My concern, if I'm a team that's interested in signing Serginho Dest, is just that he's been injured a lot throughout his career. So that's probably true if I'm a Premier League team or if I'm a Ligue 1 team.
I think I do think of the Premier League as more physical or maybe more intense. I don't know. Maybe that's just because I watch it more. But I would be a little bit concerned about that. With that said, I think about a club who had an American fullback who I had concerns about his defensive positioning and ability and is now a lights-out defender who starts every single game for them and also facilitates attacking play. I feel like Fulham might be an interesting spot for Serginho Dest to go. He can partner Anthony Robinson. We can get the American three of the back four with Tim Ream in there too. Let's get Walker Zimmerman in and just make it a full back four. What could go wrong? But I do think like that is maybe the size of club that I think could work better for him is one where there is some attacking play, some possession-oriented play, but at the same time, it's not going to be this world-class team where one bad performance and he's out like on the outside looking in.
Yeah, I think Fulham would be a good fit off the top of my head for Dest. They weren't on my list. I think I'm a little bit hotter on Dest than maybe most people on this podcast. I think I've said that before. I am a Serginho Dest fan. I thought he was harshly treated at Barcelona. I thought Xavi kind of made up his mind very quickly on him, and even when Dest was playing pretty well, was still saying things about him in press conference situations, and so I wasn't surprised to see him leave Barcelona. I think Dest's biggest problem, besides injuries of course, but his biggest problem is he's made two bad career decisions in a row. So Barcelona maybe wasn't that immediately because Ronald Koeman's there, he has an ally there, but then it becomes that when Xavi takes over. AC Milan has been a bad career decision for Serginho Dest because of their injuries, yes, but also because, you know, with Teo bombing forward on the left side, Pioli tends to kind of shuffle it into a back three with Calabria on the right of the defence, and then kind of in possession that becomes a back three, and Dest obviously isn't good enough in that role. And then you also have, Kalulu will be on the right side of the back three. But then you also have like Junior Messias playing as a right wing back in that team on occasion, and I don't think Dest can perform that role either. So they kind of toggle between two systems and approaches that don't suit Sergino Dest. I still think he's only 22. I still think there's room for him to grow and develop and get up back to the elite level. But I do agree his next move needs to just be somewhere where he's going to play. And I don't know whether the symbolism of him going back to Ajax is not going to be ideal for him, and it kind of underlines his regression, the fact that he'd be going back to the club where he broke through. But Ajax's right back situation right now isn't ideal. So Rensch has been playing that position for them this season. He is very raw. I read some articles saying that Ajax are looking to replace him. They'd be looking for a right back for the start of next season. Ajax are traditionally a dominant team within their league, so I think that style, that possession style, suits him. But you maybe don't have the strength of attackers to expose him in a defensive sense. So if there was the right coach at Ajax to work on some of his weaknesses, I wouldn't be against him going back to Amsterdam.
All right. Thank you, Hugh, for that question. Let's move on to one from Bobby Drexler. Hi, guys, says Bobby. So in FIFA, you can manage both a club team and receive offers to manage a national team at the same time. Has there ever been an instance of this happening in real life? And if we could choose a manager to do this for the USMNT, where he wouldn't have to worry about them leaving their position, who would we want, says Bobby. Graham, in terms of previous examples, there are a fair few of them. The one that comes to the front of my mind first is Gus Hiddink, who was interim coach at Chelsea in 2009 after Luis Felipe Scolari's reign at Stamford Bridge. He was also Russia's coach at the same time. Won the FA Cup with Chelsea in his last game and then popped off back to Russia. It helps when one of Russia's most powerful people owns your club.
Yeah, there was a time when being Chelsea manager and Russia manager was basically the same thing, so it didn't really matter. I think there was also some overlap between him being PSV Eindhoven manager and Australia manager in 2005. So Gus Hiddink is essentially just the multitasking king in soccer management. Sir Alex Ferguson is another who was a club manager and an international manager at the same time. His circumstances a little bit different. So he was Scotland assistant manager at the same time as being Aberdeen manager. And then Jock Stein died during the match that Scotland qualified for the 1986 World Cup. Ferguson took over for that tournament. The weird thing was that Aberdeen actually had a co-manager for that period. So Archie Knox became Aberdeen co-manager with Ferguson to basically cover his shifts while he was Scotland manager. So yeah, I think Gus Hiddink, Alex Ferguson, obviously, he wasn't Scotland manager for a very long time, but obviously you could argue he's the greatest manager of all time, and he did it for a period as well.
That Ferguson one feels very much like senioritis to me, where I think he had already announced he was going to leave Aberdeen at the end of the season. So having a co-manager to be like, you know what, you handle it. Like, I don't feel like turning that assignment in. You can do that one. I'll be over here managing Scotland. And then off he goes to England. I had Ferguson on my list. I had Hiddink. I had Leonid Slutsky, who manages Russia. And I believe it was CSKA Moscow at the same time. So I guess Russia featuring prominently on this list. Those are some of the notable ones. I read a few different lists, and maybe I have the timelines wrong, but there are a lot of names on those lists that I don't think overlapped necessarily. Fatih Terim is one that gets mentioned a bunch as being Galatasaray manager and Turkey manager at the same time. And I think partially it's because he's done both of those, I think, three times each. He's managed Galatasaray three different times. He's managed the Turkish national team three times. But I believe all of them sort of one ends, one begins, that one ends, the next one begins. I don't know how much overlap there was with that one. Same thing with Rinus Michels or Michels. We still don't know which one it is. With Barcelona and the Dutch, I don't know if there was actual overlap there, but they were within the same year. So I think sometimes they get erroneously linked together.
One, Taylor, that came to mind just as you were speaking then, which I think is an almost happened, Ralf Rangnick. When he was at Manchester United, he was linked with the Austria job. He took the Austria job, I believe, in the April. I think it was after he was interim manager, but then he was still going to be working upstairs at Man United and do the Austria job. I don't think that came to pass in the end, but there was a confusing overlap situation there.
Yeah, I'm going to call that like Jesse Marsh's situation is a Ralph Rangnick situation, in which I think Rangnick thought, like, oh, I'll get this job long term and be able to be- no, you want me for 4 months, that's it. And it sounds like that's what Southampton wanted with Jesse Marsh as well, was you get the rest of the season and then we'll see what happens. Yeah, I think that was kind of the situation with Rangnick, but I don't know if that was because he was doing such a great job, everybody was wanting him the way it was with maybe Gus Hiddink. I think with Rangnick, it was, oh, you're not going to be around very long. I'm not going to be around very long. So let me see what else is out there. Austria sounds good.
There we go. Joe, who would we choose for the USMNT if we could job share a manager on their behalf?
Yeah, I mean, this is basically just like pick who you want in the US job now, isn't it? It just wrapped up in a different package. I put Jurgen Klopp in my notes. I don't know that I feel great about that. I think you could get a number of different really good choices from around the world right now if you don't have to worry about the salary, which, you know, by all accounts is a major hurdle for US soccer at the moment with someone like Jurgen Klopp or a Pep or a Tuchel or a Pochettino, whatever that looks like. But pretty much any of those names I think would be fascinating and would provide fascinating content. But Klopp is the one that I went with. We've seen him work on the press. We've seen him shift over time to becoming more possession oriented. It sort of seems to me like he is a manager who has experience balancing different styles in different moments. So the U.S., their big issue a lot of the times, although less so heading into 2026 because they don't have to qualify, is that against the small teams, they got to be dominant on the ball because they're going to have to control and they're going to have to create. It's hard to do that stuff, especially when against the big teams, you're still not like the better team on the field. We saw against England, the U.S. sat in a 4-4-2 mid-block, like 2019 style at the World Cup. And they frustrated England and sort of switched up how they played. So I think Klopp could do a good job of oscillating back and forth between the two. The other part of this, though, fellas, is I honestly cannot imagine wanting to do this. Like, why as a manager would you want to do both of these things at the same time? It feels like way too much work. It feels like it's bad for your initial employer, also bad for bad for the second person you're going to work for. I guess it's for the bag, but why not go do a Mancini? Like, why not go finesse your way into like a 4-day consultant job for seven figures? Like, why not go and do Twitch streams like Luis Enrique? There's so many other ways to make money, especially now. Maybe less so back when Gus Hiddink was doing some of that stuff. All right, fair enough. Even still, there were opportunities. But today in 2023, like, get a TikTok account or something. Don't do two jobs at the same time. It doesn't make sense to me.
I think, Joe, it's an excuse to do three jobs, because if you want, if you love collecting air miles, you could get one of those YouTube channels where they do like the hacks to get all around the world. And if you had two jobs where you're required to do that, then you've got three jobs. And it just if you like being busy.
I don't. I'm going the other way. Doesn't make sense.
I vote hologram. we create a hologram technology so that Jurgen Klopp can manage Liverpool and the US simultaneously. So when we've got a January camp, hologram Klopp is. He's going to choose the U.S. for January camp. He'll be in the United States for that one. He'll be hologram managing Liverpool. I don't see how this doesn't work.
Or, so at my wife's work, they do like secondments for jobs. So we make the U.S. men's national team manager's job the world soccer's secondment, and you have a different manager drafted in just like every month. So you have like Klopp 1 month, Pochettino another month. Yeah, I'm sure that'll be fine. Continuity won't be a problem at all.
And if maybe listeners, I don't know how they couldn't, but if they had no idea what a secondment was, Graham, could you explain that one, please?
You do someone else's job for a short period of time, then you go back to your old job. That's it. It is a real word. Google it.
Yeah,
were other people familiar like with this?
Yeah, totally. Like, it's kind of like, not a sabbatical, but like a big multinational company will say, go work in our New York office for 6 months. And it's a secondment, that kind of thing.
Then you go back to your original job at the end.
I have learned new things today. Thank you, Graham.
There you go.
We should do. But whatever.
That's what we do with US soccer.
All right.
Have secondment managers.
Secondment is good. Klopp GPT as well. We'll just use an AI. Oh, no. How about that?
Klopp GPT. I really think, though, if we were going to do this, like if there were going to be like any manager pick one, I think Joe is right. I think Klopp is a great one for all the reasons already espoused, but then also because I think back to Pia Sundhage managing the U.S. women's national team when they find a way to win at the very end, and she says a line, something along the lines of like, there really is something to this like American spirit, this never say die attitude. Like, there is just this intangible. And that resonated so hard with every U.S. media outlet, every U.S. fan. I think people loved that. And I can absolutely see a, like, reinvigorated Happy Klopp being like, this is great. This is so much fun. Like, I can see him being very into the, like, hard work, we're going to grind mentality that I think the U.S. has embraced in the past. And I could see him being the kind of enthusiastic, charismatic leader that kicks them on to next levels. And I would also add that Jurgen Klinsmann was, I believe, the second highest paid coach at the World Cup in 2014. So if U.S. wants to plead poverty, yikes, you already paid somebody. You can pay somebody again.
He got a new job this week, I saw. He's at South Korea now.
Yes, he is.
South Korea's new national team manager.
Mm-hmm.
Good
luck. I look forward
to
them having zero tactical discipline at the next World Cup. Should be great.
Oh, boy. All right. Thank you, Bobby, for that question. Let's take one more quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk NWSL, and we're going to talk about Landon. Back shortly.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Total Soccer Show, welcome back to our listener questions. Aaron Breeding has been in touch and said, if the NWSL were to participate in the UEFA Women's Champions League, how would they do in that competition? I think the team sent would be NWSL Cup winner, the Shield winner, and then either the Challenge Cup winner or a runner-up of the competition. Joe, I'll let you kick off with this one. What do you think? How well would this work out if NWSL teams entered the UEFA Champions League?
I think they'd do well. I think they'd compete. I don't think they would be automatic winners or anything close to that. It's difficult here because we don't have a lot of data points that give us a look at how these kinds of teams would fare against each other. And really, when I say these kinds of teams, I kind of mean the top of the NWSL and the top of Europe. So Barcelona, Lyon, PSG, maybe to a slightly lesser extent, Wolfsburg. I mean, those are the class of women's club soccer in Europe at the moment and have been for a little while now. The best reference point I could find, which I'm not convinced is all that good, is the International Champions Cup, which for the women's side is a much better representation of quality and actual matchups than the men's side. Just to get that out of the way, it's not just like, you know, Tottenham coming over to play Porto for no reason. You actually do have teams trying to go out there and play a lot of the time their best lineup. So I believe there have been four, you know, recent editions of this competition, 2018, 19, 21, and 22. NWSL teams won two of the four. Lyon won the other two, basically. So the Courage won in 2018, Portland won in 2021, and Lyon won in 2019 and 2022. I think that's probably about right. I don't think an NWSL team, Portland, OL Reign, you know, maybe Utah, San Diego in there after a strong year last year, the best teams in the NWSL, I don't think they are blowing any of those, you know, elite European teams out of the water. But I also don't think they're getting embarrassed either. I don't know. Taylor, Graham, do either of you guys disagree strongly here? Did you have a problem with trying to compare just because you don't have the data? What did this look like?
Yeah, I agree with everything that you've said. I also struggled to... With the men's game, obviously, it's easy to just look at the talent of the two teams from two different continents and say, well, that team is clearly better. It's more difficult to do that with NWSL teams and then Women's Champions League teams. So if you go to the Thorns and just go through their team, you know, it's household names. You know, Sophia Smith, Janine Beche, Christine Sinclair, and then you look at Lyon, Wendy Renard, you know, Lindsay Horan, Caterino Macario, Ada Hegerberg, you know, then Barcelona, Pateas, who obviously won the I was going to say the Ballon d'Or, but it's not the Ballon d'Or, actually. What is it? FIFA's best female player or whatever that award is. She won that this week. Hermoso, Graham Hansen, Kira Walsh is at Barcelona as well. So on a talent basis, I kind of struggle to split them. I might take Lyon as the winners just because they have that muscle memory and they've won it so many times before. But I agree, Joe. I think, you know, teams like the Thorns and OL Reign and you know, the Courage as the Challenge Cup winners would be up there and competitive. I just can't really make a solid judgment on who would win.
Yeah, basic retweet. I would just add, I think they, if you did this for like a couple seasons in a row, I think they improve each year. I think the first year, the depth of the top tier teams, as has already been laid out, I think would be an issue. But also, it's just a different animal. It's a different thing. We've talked about it with the Real Madrid men's team. As Graham just said, there's a few teams that do have that muscle memory. And I think it would just be more of a slog and a different type of slog because NWSL doesn't really have the league and a major cup competition existing at the same time. So it's just a different entity to have to try to handle. And I think it would take a little bit of time to navigate that or get more comfortable with it. And then I think they'd start winning from there. So I think it would be basically what Joe said. I think they'd be fine and competitive.
This should happen, though. Yeah. I'm fully on board with this happening. So I think with the women's game and the development that still needs to happen, you can make an argument that getting the best teams together in the same competition would have a real benefit, where I can't really make that argument for the men's game. I don't have any great desire to see like LAFC in the Champions League, but some NWSL teams in the Women's Champions League, I think, would benefit everyone. I think the Women's Champions League gets stronger. I think the players benefit. I think fans benefit. So, yeah, let's make this happen.
They've done it in the past with some ICC stuff where they would have teams come over here and compete. Like, I think the Courage beat Lyon in the final of that one. But then you have that same thing of one team is going to be in mid-season, one team is going to be in preseason, and you rarely get the situation in which they're both sort of at prime competition level in a competition that truly matters, that has weight behind it. So I think those get kind of touted as like, well, we've seen it happen and the Courage won. But I think that's kind of a different entity to what we're talking about here.
Indeed. Very good thought exercise there, Aaron. Thank you very much for that question. We move on to Graham Bailey. This question is mainly for the British contingent. And now I realize why the name is Graham Bailey. But the American contingent can answer this question as well, says Graham Bailey. Help me understand the City of London. I feel like there are about 145 teams based in London. How big is London? How do all the teams fit? Is there actually multiple cities, but they couldn't think of different names? Yeah, London's quite big, I suppose, is my first answer to that one, Graham. There are 17 professional teams in London. And if you count sort of the area just outside the ring road that goes around at the M25, Watford and Luton and teams like that, you could add even more to the mix as well. Obviously, yeah. Premier League teams, you've got Tottenham, Arsenal, West Ham, Chelsea, Fulham, Palace and Brentford. So, London is big. It historically has a lot of teams in it, Graham. And I've got a list of actually other major world cities that have quite a lot of teams in them too, but I'll let you answer this question too.
Well, no, run through that first so we can get an idea of how London compares to some of the other cities, because it does have an ecosystem that I think is unparalleled in world football, but just lay that out for us.
Sure. So as I say, 17 professional teams, of whom 7 are in the Premier League, the teams I mentioned there. There's a few comparisons you can make. Istanbul's got a few, Besiktas, Fenerbahce, Galatasaray. The Qatari League, 7 of 12 teams are in Doha. Who'd have thought that?
Oh, that doesn't count.
So they equal the London, arguably, arguably. I think the one that comes closest, from what I could see, is Buenos Aires as well, with Boca Juniors, River Plate, San Lorenzo, Huracan, Vélez Sarsfield, and Argentinos Juniors as top flight teams. Right. So there are other large conurbations that also have a lot of teams focused in them. But I suppose it just comes back to history and geography, doesn't it, Graham? London being the central point of England with a high population density, inevitably the most popular sport brings a lot of teams with it.
Yeah, another thing about London is, and I think Graham, if that is his real name in the question, I doubt it is, but in Graham's question, he kind of says, I think he's joking and saying, is it different cities? They couldn't think of different names. Well, my impression of London is that is kind of the case with London. You just have lots of different communities. You know, it's very difficult to get from one place to the other. It takes a lot of time, and you will pass through those communities that each have their own identity. And I have been to other cities, and I know that is not something that is entirely unique to London. You know, you go to New York, there are different communities, but I don't know, my impression of London is it feels like there are even more communities than most other cities, and they each want to have a football club that reflects that identity. And then obviously you factor in the history and the fact that they've been playing soccer in London for longer than most cities on the planet. So those two things combined just means that there's more clubs, because my impression is that there's not really a unified London identity in the way that there might be in other world cities, you know, so each of those communities, as I say, have their own club.
Yeah. And Taylor, in terms of how all those teams fit, I think it's quite simple. There's no Chili's in London, so they use all that space to build stadiums. Fewer dentists, arguably, as well. There's a lot of reasons why we can fit more fields in, basically.
You don't need to do this, Ryan Bailey. That's for them.
I mean, it is basically, it's just that it was the capital of the British Empire, and then they had several policies, and then the Industrial Revolution that sort of drew everybody to that one central location. And then within that, I think you're going to get sort of neighborhoods that become their own entity, their own sort of city within a city, and then those neighborhoods will have a club that they identify with, or vice versa, and then it kind of grows from there. And I think that's one of the coolest things about the Premier League, is how many teams you have within touching distance or close to touching distance. Like what, Fulham and Chelsea are maybe 3 miles apart, if that. Like they're very close, and I think that does create some of those rivalries. When you look at the map of London divided up into like the areas that support which club, there's so many areas that have like two and three teams that are divided loyalties that I think it makes for just an interesting dynamic for sure.
Yeah, it was interesting when I was a kid, Taylor, and you looked at the map of London and all the teams and which areas, which teams were supported. It was entirely red for Manchester United.
Not that you're better about that.
Well, red for Manchester United and then red for Arsenal at the same time. Those feel like the two that would have been kind of dominant.
Maybe a little bit of Arsenal in the counties that are around London, possibly. But that's my playground experience was that. And some one Blackburn thing, fans thing, when they were good for one season.
I'm sorry, Ryan. One thing that I think is interesting that you pointed out is how I think of this as being a London phenomenon, but it really is a thing that occurs all over the place. Like you mentioned with Istanbul there, there's like at least three more teams that I can think of that play in that city. So it is, I think, more of a common thing. I think just that London has quite so many, it really does kind of put it at the top of that list.
The funny thing about London is, obviously, they have Wembley Stadium, which is the national stadium. No club team plays there. And so I just think that's funny that in London they were like, we need a national stadium. You can't move for football stadiums, but they needed another national stadium that isn't used every single week.
Yeah.
They needed an Olympic one too, I believe.
Yeah. They built a separate Olympic stadium, even though they did have an Olympics at Wembley previously, a few decades earlier. And there's also Twickenham, a national rugby stadium at which no team plays either. So lots of empty stadiums as well, Graham.
Yeah, very efficient.
Very efficient.
Wembley and Twickenham are very English stadium names, I have to say.
Twickenham.
Twickers, darling, is what we call it.
No. Nails down a chalkboard, that. Twickers.
Ugh. Yeah, it's very rugby. Joe, very a quick stat for you, Joe. Did you know that London teams have won 21 more English championships than Phoenix, Arizona?
Wow. That kind of blows my mind.
True, right?
Man. Ryan dropping the Opta level stats out here. Good work.
Yeah.
Wait.
I need to
what?
How many, like one word afterwards to
how many? Yeah, right,
Ryan.
Right. Massive period. How many, Ryan, yeah, how yeah. many how many Premier League titles has your neighborhood won? That's the real question.
Oh, if you count all the players, all of them.
Okay, right. That's what I was looking for.
Yeah. Ryan, how far does that go back? That stat you just listed.
The stat I found was 21 English championships, that's Premier League and First Division, 35 FA Cups, 12 League Cups, 8 Community Shields.
Is that not a small amount? For every club in London combined, they've won 21 titles?
So the Northwest is like 53 or something.
Yeah. I mean, what, Liverpool and Manchester United combined for 38, I think, something like that. Or 40.
Yeah, and then you've got Man City, who have a good haul now, and Leeds are in there. So
London, the city that wins everything, the capital city of football, except for that they don't win that much.
Yeah, Taylor, you have to remember, before Rupert Murdoch invented soccer in 1992 with the Premier League, it was mainly the Northwest that won everything. So that's a
reason why.
Yeah, and after Rupert Murdoch and Sky, it was also in the Northwest. They were called Manchester United. That's why everyone in London supported them, Ryan Bailey, as you were just telling us.
I feel like and you all are baiting me into talking about Manchester United to then get mad at me for talking about Manchester United. That's what this seems to be, and I'm not buying it. I'm not buying it.
Ryan, he's seen through it. He's seen through it.
Taylor, shut up.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Graham Bailey, for that question. One more from Calvin Lazum.
Oh, wait, hey, this Ryan, sorry. I had one more point to add. It was... you shut up.
Point taken. Banter. Thank you very much.
This is descending into farce.
We're over an hour,
this
folks.
This is what happens when we're bring not. Ryan back.
Yeah, yeah. You shouldn't do that. There you go. That's what happens. Calvin Lazum says, what discontinued soccer competition would you bring back? There have been plenty. I've got a few examples. Who wants to go first? Joe, any discontinued soccer contests?
My answer is there's too much soccer already, and I'm not touching anything that's been discontinued. Taylor, you said it well in the pre-show. I think you said something to the effect of, like, I did some research and can see why these were discontinued.
Yep.
So the only thing that I have to say on this question, it's short, it's sweet. It's not a competition in the way that I think Calvin is getting at, but it is a competition in the battle of wills and throws and kicks between people that get to wear gloves. It's goalie wars. Not between teams, between people. I am almost 100% sure that's not what Calvin was looking for, but it is the only thing I have written down in my notes because I truly, truly do not want us to resurrect anything that's already been chopped.
Wait, Joe, clarify what that is. I know we've spoken about this previously, but I have forgotten.
Oh, yeah,
I'm
okay.
Gundam.
Fair enough. So you set the goals like really close to each other. I don't know what the distance is, maybe 20, 30 yards. And it's just two goalkeepers, one in each goal, and they take turns. They can either chuck the ball into the back of the other goalkeeper's net, like long throw style, or they can kick it, and you get points for getting the ball past the other goalkeeper, and you play to a set amount. MLS, I think, is getting closer and closer to bringing this back, like, for real around the All-Star.
Wait, so where did this take... All-Star weekend. That was where it used to happen.
I believe, right. Taylor, that was the origin of Goalie Wars. It was back, you know, a while ago around all the All-Star festivities. Yeah. And they're sort of... they tested it last year. I was there in Minnesota, and they did it during mostly, like, commercial breaks for when all the other All-Star stuff was happening, which was a real bummer. But it was excellent to watch in person. It's funny. It's good. It's not, like, another 18 game commitment for everybody involved, players, coaches, everybody like that. So, yeah, goalie wars.
Wait
until
Gerard Piqué gets hold of it. It
yeah.
will be a full
with balloons. You do it with balloons. That's what you do. I'm down.
Oh dear, that's an excellent suggestion. Graham, do you remember the Anglo-Italian Cup?
It's on my list.
Yeah, there you go. So it ran from 1980, I believe, to 96, and it had various different guises. I think it was originally supposed to be the League Cup winner taking on the Coppa Italia winner. So then you get, like, Swindon against Juventus. You get these really weird matches in it. But that was a lot of fun when you had two sort of different leagues going up against each other in a tournament, and they introduced, like, a 16 version of it as well. That was... mentioning it now. Nah, we don't need it.
So it was on my list just purely to aggravate you. I just wanted to see how worked up you would get about an Anglo-Italian Cup. But also going through the past winners and teams that were in this competition, I'm not sure England were sending their best to this tournament. Because if you look through the English teams, Swindon, Blackpool, Wickham Wanderers, and then you look at the Italian teams, Napoli, Roma, Bologna, Fiorentina. So there is an imbalance there where it feels like England maybe wasn't holding up their end of the bargain.
Yeah, England at one point started sending second. They made it a second tier contest. Only teams in the second division could go.
I think from what I read, it's because at the time, third division clubs weren't allowed into European competition. So if a third division team won a cup, which they did, they couldn't then go play in the European competitions. So that the Anglo-Italian Cup existed basically to give those teams that won an opportunity to play in Europe against better opposition. My guess would be that those teams stopped winning the FA Cup because the Premier League. And then from there, it kind of, I mean, I think it stopped existing before that. I might be wrong. But that was an interesting one. I also enjoyed that every article I read, because I kept trying to find more detail about it, every single one kind of lost steam about two sentences in. It was just like, it existed. It was a thing. Like, Italy won it once. I don't know. Whatever. It doesn't matter. I was into the Cup Winners' Cup as well. Then I read about why it declined. And yeah, that's basically it. Every single one of these, I feel like there is a very good answer as to why most of them stopped functioning. And the answer is usually because of the Champions League.
Yeah, indeed. Graham, any other noms?
Yeah, so the competition that I really need in my life is the Tennent Sixes. So this was an indoor tournament played in the 80s and 90s. And I know we're all familiar with Masters football, where it's retired legends who play indoor soccer. Well, this was the actual teams. So you have Celtic and Rangers and Hearts and Hibs and all the big clubs with six-a-side teams, and they played for a week in you know, an indoor arena in Glasgow. And those teams were made up of their best players, and people still talk about this like every year. There's videos surface on social media because it just seems like so ridiculous that these teams sent their best players to go and play these six-a-side games. But yeah, I actually think, to be serious, if they brought it back, it would be such an effective way to promote Scottish football. There's nothing like that in world football, and people would talk about it. So yeah, let's bring back Tennent Sixes.
Graham, you've actually tapped on the correct answer, because I was going to endorse a similar contest that happened in London. And I remember it vividly, and used to love watching it every year. It's called the London Five-a-Sides. So it was five-a-side, indoor tournament, usually at Wembley Arena. It actually ran from 1954 until 1995. And as the name suggests, it was all the London teams who play like a knockout tournament. And it was wild, because you watch like Premier League teams in their Premier League kits wearing like white sneakers on an indoor court. And you could tell like some players who were really good on an 11-a-side field were like terrible at five-a-side, and vice versa. It was absolutely brilliant. Wimbledon actually made two finals of the London five-a-sides. I completely agree. But the concept of taking a few days off, like the British version of the League's Cup, we'll take a month off to do some five-a-side. I'm all in on that. I think that would be so good.
Yeah, that's really good. That's really good.
I am joking, but also not really joking. If they brought back tournaments like that, I would be fully on board. I would enjoy them a lot.
There we go. All right, let's start the campaign. But in the meantime, that was Listener Questions. Taylor Rockwell, thank you so much. I'm sorry I told you to shut up. I love you.
Right back at you, buddy.
Joe Lowry, thank you very much for all your help on this one.
Yeah, thank you, Ryan.
And Graham Bailey, a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Ryan Bailey.
Yeah, that was weird. Thank you very much, listener, for tuning in on this one. We'll be back on the feed very shortly, but for now, bye!